reading Matthew chapter 19. So then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. Then they said, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they struck him with their hands. Pilate then went out and said to them, "Behold, I'm bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no fault with him." Then Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. And Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Therefore, when the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." Then Jesus answered him, Then the Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid, and went again to the praetorium and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Then Pilate said to him, "Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you?" Jesus answered, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the power, has the greater sin." But then Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, "If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and sat down in the judgment seat in the place that is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. And it was the preparation day of the Passover, and about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." But they cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify!" Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Then they delivered him to be crucified. So they took Jesus and led him away. This morning, John had read from his lesson in John chapter 18 that Caesar made in verse 38 that question, "What is truth?" I don't know Pilate's motivation. I don't know why he was hesitant to crucify Jesus, but it almost as if he had some degree of sympathy. Because after being scourged and the physical condition he would have been in, having gone through the beating that he went through, he presents him to the people and says, "Behold the man." And so this statement becomes something that he's asking for examination of Jesus. "Look at the man. Behold the man." So tonight we're going to spend some time looking at what John does in the book of John about who Jesus says he is. And so we're going to look at specifically at seven truths about Jesus that Jesus reveals about himself in John. We're going to have a video, just a short video, that's going to do an overview of the last part of John. Many of you saw the first part of this several weeks ago when we introduced some of the context of John from John chapter 1 through 12. This is going to do a synopsis of John chapter 13 to John chapter 21. John Lewis, you want to play that for us?
The Gospel according to John. In the first video, we saw that John wrote this book to make the claim that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, the human embodiment of God's Word and glorious presence, who has come to reveal who God truly is. Then we explored how John designed the first half of the book to demonstrate this claim. Jesus performed miraculous signs and made huge claims about himself, that he is the reality to which Israel's entire history points. And this all generates controversy, however, and the Jewish leaders confront Jesus for all these claims, and it culminated with Jesus laying down his life for his friend Lazarus. By going near Jerusalem to raise him from the dead, Jesus sealed his fate. And so once the plot to murder Jesus is set in motion, we come into the book's second half. The first part focuses entirely on Jesus' final night and last words to the disciples as he tries to prepare them for his coming death. Jesus performs this shocking act at dinner. He takes on the role of a common servant by kneeling down to wash their dirty feet, something that in their culture, a superior rabbi would never do for his disciples. And Jesus says it's a symbol of his entire life purpose, to reveal the true nature of God as a being of self-giving love. And it's also a symbol of what Jesus is about to do in becoming a servant and giving up his life to die for the sins of the world. And so this act leads to his great command to his disciples that they are to follow him by loving one another as he has loved them. Acts of loving generosity are to be the hallmark of Jesus' followers. This is what will show the world who Jesus is, and therefore who God is. Now from here, Jesus goes into a long flowing speech that's concluded with a prayer. And you'll find the whole thing is unified by a few repeated themes. Jesus keeps saying that he's going away, which makes the disciples sad, but Jesus says it's for the best because it means that he will send the Spirit, also known as the Advocate. As a human, Jesus can only be in one place at a time, but the Spirit can be Jesus' divine personal presence in any place at any time. And the Spirit will do a number of things, Jesus says. So remember, for John, the unique deity of the one God consists of that loving, unified relationship between the Father and the Son. Jesus says the Spirit is that loving personal presence that will come to live in his people and draw them into the love between the Father and the Son. And so, Jesus says, his disciples are the ones who abide or remain in that divine love, the way that branches are connected to a vine. He's describing here how the personal love of God can permeate a person's life, healing, transforming, and making them new. And there's more. The Spirit will also empower Jesus' followers to carry on his mission in the world, to first of all fulfill the great command to love others through radical acts of service. But also, Jesus says, the mission is to bear witness to the truth, to expose and name the selfish, sinful ways that we as humans treat each other, and to declare that in Jesus, God has saved the world through him because he loves it. He's opened up a new way to become human again. And so finally, Jesus predicts that there will be opposition. Just as the Jewish leaders rejected him, so his followers will be persecuted. But he tells them not to be afraid because he has already conquered or gained victory over the world. Now, what does Jesus mean by victory here? He doesn't say. But it leads us into the final section of the book where John shows us what victory looks like, Jesus style. The Jewish leaders send soldiers to Jesus and his disciples to arrest him. And when the soldiers ask which one Jesus is, he declares, "I am," and they fall backward. Now, this is brilliant on John's part. These words are the culmination of two sets of seven instances where Jesus has used that very phrase. And it all highlights one of John's core claims about Jesus. The words "I am," or in Greek, "ego emi," they're the Greek translation of the Hebrew personal covenant name of God that was revealed to Moses back in Exodus chapter 3. It was also repeated many times in Isaiah. And John has strategically placed seven moments in his story where Jesus says, "I am," followed by some astounding claim. "I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world, the gate for the sheep, the good shepherd, the resurrection, the way, the truth, and the life, the true vine." And John's also designed seven other stories that have key moments where Jesus says simply, "I am," echoing this divine name. And so here, this occurrence, as Jesus is arrested, it's the ironic climax of all of them, because Jesus reveals his divine name and power and victory precisely at the moment that he gives up his life. After this, Jesus is put on trial for his exalted claims to be the Son of God and the King of Israel, first before the high priest and then before the Roman governor Pilate, who has to take seriously anyone who's charged with claiming to be the King of Israel. And Jesus tells Pilate that, "My kingdom is not from this world," meaning that he is a king and that his kingdom is for this world, but it's radically different value system, its redefinition of power and greatness. None of this is derived from this world. Rather, they are defined by God's character that Jesus has revealed through his upside-down kingdom, which is epitomized by the cross. It's the place where the world's true king conquers sin and evil by letting it conquer him. And Jesus gains victory over the world through an act of self-giving love. After this, Jesus' body is placed in a tomb that is then sealed. And on the first day of the week, Mary and then later the other disciples discover that the tomb is strangely open and then empty. And then Mary, all of a sudden, she meets Jesus. He's alive from the dead. Now, the resurrection of Jesus connects back to another pattern of sevens in John's gospel. So all the way back at the wedding party in Cana, when Jesus turned the water into wine, John told us that that was Jesus' first sign. And he also identified the second sign, the healing of the sick boy in chapter 4. But after this, John just lets you keep count. And if you have, you'll have noticed that the sixth sign was the raising of Lazarus from the tomb, which Jesus performed at the cost of his own life. And so that, and all of the signs, they point forward to this seventh and greatest sign at the culmination of the story, Jesus' own resurrection from the dead. It vindicates Jesus' claim to be the Son of God, the author of all life, whose love has conquered death itself. After the empty tomb, Jesus then meets up with all the disciples, and he commissions them by sending the Spirit as he promised, so that his mission from the Father can now be carried on through them. After this, the book concludes with an epilogue that explores the ongoing mission of Jesus' disciples in the world. So a number of them are fishing, and they're not catching anything. And so Jesus appears to them on the shore. They don't recognize him, though. And he tells them to cast their net on the other side of the boat. And when they obey him, they catch a huge amount of fish, and it's only then that they recognize him as Jesus. Now, John's offering here a picture of discipleship to Jesus. His followers will be most effective in the world when their focus is not on their work as such, but on simply listening for Jesus' voice and obeying him when he speaks. That's when they will truly see him at work in their lives. After this, Jesus talks with Peter and then commissions him as a unique leader in the Jesus movement, indicating that he too will give up his life one day. But in contrast to Peter, the last moments of the story focus on the author of this gospel, the disciple whom Jesus loved. And unlike Peter, his job was not to lead the Jesus movement, but rather to spend his long life bearing witness to Jesus so that others might believe in him. And that's actually what he's done right here by authoring this amazing story about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. And that's what the Gospel of John is all about.
So let's bring the lights back up again. So let's spend some time in our class to look at these seven truths about Jesus that John reveals. And knowing this, I mean, when we profess Jesus as King and Lord of our life, I've said this before. We rush through that confession sometimes. We don't let it bear the weight it needs to bear. But this is the big question. What is truth? And the truth is who Jesus is and reveals about himself. So let's look a little bit tonight at what these seven I ams that Jesus makes, these seven statements of Jesus. And the first one, Jesus declares he's what? The bread of life. You know, so what is the importance of this statement, that Jesus refers to himself as the bread of life? What is the importance of that statement? What kind of visual images does that bring to you? Okay. So we need physical food to survive, you know. So we need Jesus is something about our survival, but what other imagery does that borrow against? The idea of the bread of life. Remember how God provided for the folks in the wilderness? He gave them manna, the sustaining presence of God's blessing. It's not something they could create for themselves. It's something that God gave them and that God sustained them with it. There's a lot of interesting parts about how God has revealed himself through the Word and how the Word is so connected over the generations of mankind. But remember where Jesus was born? Where was Jesus born? Bethlehem, okay? And so that Bethlehem is a very interesting word. It's two words put together. It's the word for house, which in Hebrew is the word Beit. And so it sort of anglicizes Beth, okay? And then it's also the Hebrew word for bread, which is lechem. And so Bethlehem, Beit Lechem, Beit Lechem, Bethlehem comes down to us today. So the bread of life comes from the house of bread, and we cannot live without sustenance. So when Jesus says, I'm the bread of life, he's inviting people to the understanding that he sustains us. We studied about the Lord's Supper, you know. And what does Jesus do in the Lord's Supper? He takes bread and says what? You know, take, eat, this is my body. Now, of course, as we do it, we get a little piece of cracker or whatever. But what does that symbolically represent? His body, but going beyond that, what's the meaning behind the symbolic representation? Yeah, he is our life. He's a sustaining force. He brings to us what we need and stuff. So the idea that he is, I am the bread of life. Okay. So number two, in John 8:12, Jesus declares he's what? He's the light of the world. Okay. So the idea of light imagery in Scripture is really important. And in fact, many years ago, when they began to uncover some of the scrolls in and around Qumran, known as the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's a lot of the scrolls that are not necessarily copies of biblical texts, but the texts of the community, and they refer to themselves as the sons of light, and they contrast themselves against the sons of darkness. Okay, so why is darkness such a bad thing, or what does darkness represent spiritually? Sin? Evil? Chaos? You know, when we begin to understand who God is, you know, and through the revelation of Scripture, and God says, "Let there be light," okay, and then creation tends to continue from that point in time. But God said, "The light is good." Okay, so God in his declaration said, "Light is good." We've been studying in 1 John on Sunday mornings. And there's three revelations that John makes about who God is. But one, he says, you know, God is light. You know, and John, in 1 John chapter 1, says, in him is no darkness at all. Now, it's amazing sometimes how really smart people can't seem to understand who God is and the nature of God, but they understand other things. Okay, so in the physical world, what is darkness? What is darkness? The absence of light. You know, so clearly, if we can understand in the physical world to make it dark, what do we have to do? Turn off the light. You know. So what is the reality? What is the truth? The truth is the light, you know. So and so we understand, but then we take this a little bit further. You know, morally speaking, what is evil? The absence of good. So if we can have absolute light, we can also have absolute good, you know. What is hate? The absence of love, you know. So we do understand that the physical world teaches that there are these polar opposites, and the absence of one creates the other. So the absence of light creates darkness. God is true light. The absence of love creates hate. So God is love. And so the absence of truth is lies, deceit, you know. So God is true. God is light. God is love. Okay. What is... Unfortunately, we've been experiencing a lot of this. What is cold? The absence of heat. Okay. So we have all these things that exist, but sometimes very smart people can't seem to understand that if all this is true in the physical world, there must be also something true in the spiritual world. And the God is the embodiment of this. And Jesus says that I am the light of the world. So pulling back from if you will, to 10,000 feet, if you think about Genesis, and then you think about Jesus' statement here in John, before there was light in the world, what was it? Scripture says, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Okay, so but then God brings light into the world, and that because of light, guess what? Life can exist. We know that in the physical world, if you have complete darkness, you're not going to grow plants. You're not going to grow much vegetation. You've got to have the presence of light and stuff. So now Jesus is now making this statement. Remember how John starts in the beginning. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. You know, and he talks about who Jesus is. But now here Jesus is saying, I am the light of the world. So do you remember the context of what feast Jesus has been observing in the context of this time? What feast that at this point in time they're actually observing the Festival of Lights, which we know as Hanukkah. And remember the miracle of the Hanukkah was the oil was sustained the temple for 8 nights instead of one night as is believed it would be. So Jesus becomes the embodiment of everything there is about God, the presence of God, the presence of God's word. So that's really important thing that Jesus declares in this truth about him. I'm the bread, I'm the light of the world. Number three, in John chapter 10, verse 7, Jesus declares that he is what? The gate for the sheep. So we're removed a little bit from shepherds and sheep and so forth. And so we're missing some of the context of this. And so I guess to help us better understand what he means here is that sheep are stupid animals. Okay. They're not the most intelligent animals. They get in trouble. They roam off. They're just not the smartest of animals. I remember years ago, I told you the story before, Sam Winfrey had some sheep at his place. His kids used to raise sheep and show sheep in 4-H when they were little. And Sam's barn caught fire, and the barn burned to the ground. And I saw Sam right afterwards. I said, did you lose any sheep? He says, we don't know yet. It's not cooled down enough for us to check. And I says, well, what do you mean? I said, you have sheep in the barn? He says, no. He said, sheep, when they're frightened, do stupid stuff. He says, sometimes frightened sheep will run into a burning barn because that's where they believe safety's at. They'll actually run into a burning barn and burn up because they're just not really, really, really smart. You know? And so that they have to be protected. They're very vulnerable to predators. I mean, and so they have to be protected. That's why you had the role of the shepherd. But sheep were very put in a fold. Maybe an area that they can sometimes use brush and stuff to build like a little perimeter. Sometimes it could be more fortified than that, maybe with stone or whatever. But the sheep would be driven into a fold to keep them safe, especially from predators at night. Sheep don't see very well in the dark. Okay, so a lot of the predators come out at dark. And the shepherd would literally lay in the doorway, the gate, if you will. They would lay down in the gate. Okay, that kept kept the sheep in, and what else? Kept the predators out. Okay, and so Jesus is saying, "I am the gate. I'm the one who lays between my sheep and the world. You know, I'm the buffer. You know, I'm the one. Now, in doing this, Jesus used a lot of shepherd language. He says, "I know my sheep know me. They know my voice. They recognize me." And sheep do have that capacity to sort of know who the shepherd is, and if someone else shows up, they're Larry, but the shepherd comes, they come running. So Jesus used a lot of this, but the ideal The purpose of this statement is, he says, my people understand that I put myself in the gate. I am the gate. I'm the one who stands between them and that. So it's really very powerful imagery there again, because we're not really familiar with sheep keeping and stuff. We sort of miss some of that. So in John 10, verse 11, just a few verses down, Jesus says what? He is the good shepherd. And in this, he says, I will lay down my life for my sheep. This is foreshadowing what Jesus is going to ultimately do at the cross. But he says, I'm the good shepherd. I'm willing to sacrifice myself. So remember the story of David? What were some of his, on David's resume as a shepherd boy, what were some of the things he accomplished? Yeah, he killed a lion, okay, and he protected the sheep. You know, he was brave. You know, so again, the ideal of being able to stand between and others, but the good shepherd is going to lay down his life for the sheep. I think John made a point in a lesson not too awful long ago that shepherds were not considered. We have this romanticized view of the shepherds. Oh, they must have been the most beloved people in town. And, you know, they had they had these little lambs around them. It's like that. No, they were the scourge very often. You know, that they were not necessarily the people who were highly respected. You know, back remember in the old westerns, the tensions between the cattlemen and the sheepmen and stuff like that. And everyone hated the sheep herders and that. You know, that was sort of the sentiment very often. But they were something people were familiar with, okay? It was a necessity, okay? Where, you know, we eat a lot of chicken, you know. They ate a lot of lamb, okay? And not only did the sheep provide meat for them, but provided what else? Clothes, you know. And if you're a fan of blue cheese, you know, yeah. They could also provide milk in which you can make cheeses and stuff out of. So Roquefort, things like that. So they were a high utility thing. But what else did they provide? Yeah, the wool, the sacrifice. Because I'm going to venture a guess that no one came here tonight without having insurance on your car. So what's that for? Is that an indictment against your driving skills? Is it? Some of you say, no, I'm sorry, I'm an excellent driver. I don't need insurance. No one's making that profession. So why do you need insurance for? Just in case. So the people of this time, their relationship, even though they might not have been a shepherd, their relationship between sheep was very, very close, because they need those sacrifices for the purpose of their sin. So sin could not be atoned for without an animal sacrifice. You know, so it's very, very important for them to have a close thing. And also in the context of the Passover meal, traditionally it was a lamb that was sacrificed and eaten by the family, you know, as part of the celebration. Now, I don't know how we got from eating lamb to eating ham. I don't know how we made that transition, how ham became the meat of choice for Easter, but somehow it did. And I think the Jews are probably revolting about that. But it was much very part of it. So this language that Jesus is using, I'm the good shepherd, they knew what that meant. They saw the people out in the field, but they're not. It wasn't some guy couldn't get a job anywhere else, and so he got a job as a shepherd. Jesus, but I'm a good shepherd. I'm not going to run at the first sign of something. I'm not going to abandon my flock. I'm going to attend to them. I'm going to be in the field with them. I'm going to keep them safe. I'm going to lay in the gate. I'm not going to shirk my responsibilities and duties. I am the good shepherd. And so I think he was emphasizing something that they knew. There's a lot of people who probably weren't too good in being shepherds, but they couldn't get a job doing anything else, you know. So that was that. So how does Psalm 23 help us better understand the depth of this statement? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters for his name's sake. So there's things about sheep we don't understand. Again, sheep aren't too smart. Sheep will actually get in water, and because of their wool, they can get really, really sodden really quickly and drown real quick. Okay? And so the idea of having to be led beside still waters was what? They could easily drink. You know, they don't like to, they're sort of skittish around real rapidly moving water. Lead me beside still waters. He restores my soul. Yea, though I walk through the valley of shadow death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You anoint my head with oil. What does that mean? What does all that language refer to? It's a task and skills what the shepherd did. Yes, Calvin. Right. The shepherds. Right. And very often, you know, we contrast that. Also, we go literally from shepherds to kings, you know, the wise men. I mean, and so the message is for all, you know. But the proclamation is made to the shepherds in the field, you know, guarding the flocks at night. You know. The ideal even about anointing my head with oil, what role and function did the shepherd do for that? In regards to sheep. Yeah, it's a healing process. Sheep were not smart. You know, sometimes they would have wounds and sores and stuff on their head where they, you know, try to push in the brush or whatever. And they would put oil, olive oil, which has a natural antibiotic properties, and they would anoint the head with the oil. So this was a sheep that's being cared for. I guess our modern day equivalent is Neosporin. You know, a kid gets a scratch, put some Neosporin, a Band-Aid on it. You know, that's like this magic thing here. You know, thing. But the ideal that not only does he provide, but he protects, he leads, he guides, and he heals and stuff. So there's a lot of things in Psalm 23 that I think we can borrow from. In that, so in John 11:25, Jesus declared that he is what? This is the situation with Mary and Martha and Lazarus. I'm the resurrection. Now, this is a very important statement, because a good percentage of the people of Jesus' time, if you will, one of the denominations of the Jews, I don't know if they'd be offended by that analogy, but one of the denominations of the Jews said there was no resurrection. The Sadducees that says when you're dead like rubber, you're dead all over, and it's all over. I mean, so whatever good happened, you happened in this life, and when you're dead, and that's it. Now, the Pharisees said, no, there must be more than this. There must be an afterlife. The Pharisees were open to that, but the Sadducees weren't. So I guess that in some respects, when Jesus is making this statement, he's making an indictment against the people who don't believe in the resurrection, but also that he's making a very, very powerful statement that I am the resurrection. So, you know, remember the sister's statement. I know that I'll see my brother again in the resurrection. And Jesus says, but that's me. That's who I am. So how does this statement define our hope? That more or less that Jesus is the proof of the promise. Jesus is the proof of the promise. Resurrection is not some the first fruits of the resurrection. Yeah, but resurrection is not some ideology. It's not some mythical thing out there. It's not some mystery out there. That Jesus clearly says that Mary, I'm the resurrection. I am. So we understand, and this is what we'll be spending a lot of time with next Sunday morning, about all there is to contemplate about what it means that Jesus is the resurrection, and then how does that inform us of our hope and our faith. So John chapter 14, verse 6, Jesus declares that he is the way, the truth, and the life. So, and then he goes on to say, that no one comes to the Father except by me. So how does that define our message. He's the only one that can save us, you know. And that Jesus needs to be the central part of our message. Now, I know on Sunday night, you know, we're a different church in some respects. It's sort of tongue-in-cheek say, but really sort of mean it. Sunday nights are big as 18. In some respect, that's the way it is. But the reality of it is that we hear things that it's really easy. I think John was making the point this morning that we can't hear things that we can't unhear what we've heard all of our lives. And so when we come together and we talk about Jesus, oh, yeah, I know that story. Yeah, I know he's a sheep. Yeah, I know he's the way, the truth, and life. But there's a world of people out there that this is new to them. Their ears and understandings have not been trained to that. And so we have to be very focused in our message. There are so many things in this world that can distract us. So many things can distract us. And if we're really not real careful, it'll catch us. I don't fish. I like to fish, but I don't fish. I know Michelle, she likes to fish, and several others here like to fish. But have you ever seen a buzz bait for fishing? It's an artificial lure. And I've got several. Years ago, I knew a guy, and that was his full-time job. He was a fishing guide. And so people would pay him to take them fishing. I thought, man, that is a job. You know, people would come from up north and all over the country to pay this guy to take them fishing. I mean, I don't know how you get that kind of job. Like that. But he made his own bait, okay? And he always promised he'd take me fishing. Never happens like that. But he gave me one of his baits one time. And he looked at it, and I thought, this is the most crazy thing I've ever seen in my life, okay? It was made of metal, and it was about this big, okay? And he had these little blades on it, so it would spin, okay? And then it had these little, he called them hula skirts, you know, these little rubberized little like skirt things on it. And it had a few beads on it, and it had a big hook in it. And he said, this is my most successful bait. It looked nothing like a fish. It looked like something foreign. It didn't, I mean, I can't think but a fish would think that's a UFO, but, you know, unidentified fishing object. I don't know what they think. But it didn't look anything natural. He says, I've caught more fish on this than anything. I said, how? He said, it distracts them, and it makes them curious. And they've never seen this before, so I'm just going to eat it. And he said, that's how a fish thinks. Okay. Well, Satan is not unaware of how we are, so Satan can do a lot of distraction. And if we're not real careful, we get distracted about so many wrong things in the world and so many other things that we forget the central purpose of our message. Paul said it this, I profess to know nothing except for what? Jesus Christ and Him crucified. He summarized, he was one of the best educated men of his time. He said, all I know is about Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And over again, that's who he reveals. So we need to be really myopic sometimes, saying, this is our central message, Jesus Christ and Him crucified. There's a lot of social issues we can talk about, but guess what? Like, they're always going to be there, always will be there, because man's broken, the world's broken. But the only thing that's going to fix this world is the light of the world, the bread of life, the way, the truth, and the life, the good shepherd, and the gate of the sheep. So it's really important. Okay. So lastly, in John chapter 15, 1, Jesus declares that he is the true vine. I don't know. John Ross and other folks here who collect a lot of Bible books, we probably have dozens, if not shelves, full of books that tell people how to do discipleship. And there's all these things come along, the latest and greatest way to build discipleship, the latest and greatest way to build discipleship. And there's all these great things come out. It's sort of like self-help books. I tell people, if you go to a bookstore or go to Books a Million, one of the largest sections in the store is self-help books. If they work, there wouldn't be that many of them. if reading a book and following a book was going to fix you, you wouldn't need all these other books, right? You know, there were self-help books or anything. So And I think that we can focus in. I think this is a point that sort of was brought out in the little video I showed you beforehand. We can focus in on a lot of good things and say, this is going to be our mission, and this is going to be our mission, and we're going to invest a lot of energy and talent in that. And how many times do good things start but fail? You know, one of the commentaries on the Church of Christ, we're about 15 or 20 years behind everyone else's things that they failed. But we get it 15 years later, and so we try it, we're going to do it better. And when's the last time you saw a joy bus? At one time, every church had to have dozens of joy buses. We're going to evangelize the world through joy buses. While there were great things that came out of it, they weren't the solution to discipleship. There's a lot of great things that come along, a lot of great movements and stuff, and a lot of great things, you know. I remember years ago, and a lot of effort was done to it, and there was some fruit for it. But, you know, we see, like, mass mailings. We're going to do mass mailings. We're going to mail this to everybody in the world and everybody in the household and something like that. We're going to reach Jesus that way. Yeah, some people are reached that way. But, obviously, it wasn't the end all, was it? Because when's the last time you got one of those? The way the world is reached is through a very clear gospel message about Jesus and who he is. And when we help people really connect to Jesus, the vine, he is the true vine, the authentic true vine. If you're connected to vine, you're going to bear fruit. And so it's the deepening of the relationship. It's the deepening of the understanding, both individually and collectively, that helps us be fruitful. We can, you know, we have a few blueberry bushes at the house. And Tammy, she's really much better at taking care of them than I am, because she picks them and collects them a lot better than I do. You know, and I can wish for, I can hope for, I can talk to that plant, but I still can't get blueberries to make blackberries. And I like blueberries, but I like blackberries a whole lot better. So the only thing is that a blueberry can also produce blueberry. And when someone is fully committed and connected to Jesus in a very meaningful way, they're going to produce Christ's fruit. Right? They're going to produce Christ's fruit. And so where we do sometimes, and while there's a lot of good ideas, and they may do good for a little while, but they're not sustainable, is that sometimes the action becomes a distraction and we're really not focusing on Jesus. So when we glorify and point others to Jesus, and we're fully focused on him, fruitfulness comes out naturally. There's a jelly company. And you know the slogan. With a name like Smucker's, it has to be good. Okay. Sometimes marketing companies sort of beat us to the punch. But what if we branded Christianity this way, with a name like Jesus, it has to be good. Or done in the name of Jesus, it has to be good. And that's where that true fruitfulness comes from. Well, thank you for your attention. Matt's going to lead us in a song of invitation. If there's anyone here tonight that we can assist you, maybe to deepen that relationship with Jesus. Or there may be someone here who says, listen, you know, I know who Jesus is. I know he's the Son of God. I don't doubt that. I would argue to someone who said otherwise. You know, they'd be itching for a fight for me. But for whatever reason, I have just not made that public declaration. And I've not made that next step. And so this is a holy moment. This is a special moment because the Lord's here with us. We're with one another as believers. And if you're here tonight and you would just like to step out on a statement of faith and say, I believe Jesus Christ, Son of God, be buried with him in baptism, we would celebrate that. And we know in heaven they'd be ringing the gates off, if you will, because of that celebration in heaven. But that's going to lead us in a song of your subject. We'd love to sit with you and help you at this time.